So welcome to the Art of Fearless Conversation podcast. I'm Aideen Hickey of Resonate Leadership, and I'm here again today with my partner for this series, Dr. Jeff Pelham. Hi, Jeff.
Hi there.
And our purpose here today is to explore the connections between power and psychological safety, which is fundamental to people feeling like they can speak up and have those fearless conversations we spoke about the last day. And that, in turn, is at the heart of team performance. So, Jeff, from your perspective, I was wondering, why does this topic, this connection between power and psychological safety, matter to you?
It matters to me because I think power is at the heart of the fabric of all relationships. And I also think it's not usually recognised as such. We have these discussions, we can talk about all sorts of things. If you look in the indexes of the sort of books of those kind of works we do, you'll very rarely find the word power. We don't like to look it in his face, it seems. But I think from the most macro level of international politics to the most intimate of relationships, power is there and it's a key factor in what people feel they can say, what people can do. So I don't think you can properly address this notion of psychological safety without really paying attention to the place of power in it all.
That's really interesting, Jeff. And I've been reading a book recently called The Culture Code by Daniel Coyle, and there's a quote in it that really resonated with me. He says that our unconscious brain is obsessed with sensing danger and craving social approval from superiors. I just think that's really interesting. And I guess for me, from a coaching point of view, I see how that plays out both in terms of team performance on one hand, but also at an individual level when people are, you know, fearful or craving that social approval from superiors, how sometimes that kind of constrains people and they don't bring their best selves to work. So I see that playing out in two ways. I'm curious, Jeff, what do we mean by power? Can you take us through that a bit?
Well, as always, it's a complex subject and there's kind of like many different definitions. I guess they all refer to the way in which groups or individuals can in some way or another prevail over other groups and individuals. And the kind of balance, in sense of a balance of power, because it's never all located in one place. But it is that sense of, I don't know, people getting their own way or having the capacity to define what the situation is and you know, get their point of view to become the dominant point of view. And there's that closely related notion of authority, really. So authority is the kind of, if you like, legitimate expression of power. It might be, it's always in various roles, whether it's a teacher or a parent or a manager or a CEO. So various, if you like, institutions legitimize the amount of power and how it can be used and so forth. And I think it's helpful to notice that, you know, power, we often see it as a bad thing, a negative thing, but actually it's neither good nor bad. It's just used by different groups in different ways, and depends if you know if you're in the dominant position or the on the receiving end of power, as to whether you think the effects of power are you know, good or bad.
And sometimes, Jeff, sorry, just something strikes me there. Apologies for cutting across you. That sometimes people don't realise that they have power, but it's the people who don't have it that maybe notice it a bit more.
I think that's right. I think we'll come to that in the next podcast when we talk about diversity and inclusion. When you have it, you hardly notice it often. You just exercise it and think it's kind of natural. Mm. And it's interesting, you know, rather than giving definitions of power, we all know about power. We learn about it, even if we haven't learned to articulate it, you know. We learn from the cradle, if you like, who has power, who doesn't have power, how to navigate, if you like, the lines of power. And we learn when to speak, what we can say, what we can't say. And we learn it, let's say, in the family, the nursery, the classroom, the playground. the church. And of course, we learn it in the workplace. We soon cotton on where the power lies, who you might have to ally with, where the boundaries are. So we intuitively know where power is. We know it better than we can actually put it into words most of the time.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And when I think about kind of where we start to learn about power most, my sense is that like at preschool level, it's probably more, we probably see people who look after us as caregivers more so. But when we get to school, to primary school, that's when authority kicks in, or we see this role of the formal authority, the teacher in the classroom. And I remember a teacher saying to me one time, who taught junior infants, saying that her job from September to December every year is to make sure the kids can learn to sit still. So that's like the first kind of piece of authority I'm guessing we experience. And of course, then there's that sense of power in the playground as well. And the other day, Jeff, when we were chatting, it reminded me of something that I noticed when my girls were in primary school was in the playground, or, you know, outside of school, you'd see the girls with their hair tied up in ponytails. But it became apparent that the higher the ponytail, the higher the status the girls had, the cooler they were or something. So that almost like became like the pecking order, this a visual representation of the pecking order in the playground, which was interesting. But there was this really interesting experiment, Jeff, done by a guy called Peter Skillman, who's a designer and engineer. And he did an experiment by getting groups of four people together in the University of Tokyo and Stanford and other places. And I think this kicked off about 15 years ago. And he gave them each a task to do. And the task was to construct what he called a marshmallow tower, which was made of 20 pieces of spaghetti, a meter of tape, some string, and a marshmallow would have to be put at the top. And basically they were all measured in terms of success based on how tall this tower was at the end. And in many cases, it was 0 centimeters because they just collapsed under the weight of the marshmallow at the top. But what was really interesting was he put together these different teams with, you know, maybe preschool students, with MBA students, CEOs, lawyers, all sorts of combinations, engineers that you can possibly imagine. But what was really interesting was that the preschoolers actually outperformed every other group, Jeff.
Okay. Why do you think, did he have an idea of why this was so?
Yeah, so he talked about when the MBAs got together that the interactions between them looked really, really smooth. So they kind of all sat back, they looked at the materials they had, they kind of strategized about what the right approach might be. They came up with some kind of a solution or a proposal, and then they together, you know, assembled this tower. Whereas he noted that the interactions of the preschoolers was much clunkier. There might be kind of, you know, give me that or let's do that. And they were huddling together, trying things, multiple experiments going on at the same time. And what he says is that whilst the MBAs were very smooth in their interactions on the surface, he said beneath that surface, there was a lot of kind of status management, people thinking about what should I say, who's the most important person in the room, all that kind of stuff going on. Whereas with the preschoolers, they didn't have that going on. What was going on beneath the surface was complete, was clean, but what looked like clunky behaviours actually was them working together. It was disorganised on the surface, but efficient and effective beneath the surface. They weren't competing for status. They were working shoulder to shoulder and working energetically together. And I mean, just as a matter of interest, like the results were like hugely different in that the tower was like 26 inches tall on average for the preschoolers. Whereas I think for the MBAs, if I can recall this, it was 10 inches tall, Jeff, which is a massive difference.
I think that's so interesting. I guess what you call underneath the surface is all the stuff around power. It's
yeah.
You're noticing who's got the right to speak, who you might have to defer to, checking out all those kind of alliances and all the rest of it. That I think that is so, that's the territory that's so saturated with power, and it, you know,
and it's invisible.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a guy called Bob Keegan, so Professor Bob Keegan from Harvard, and he says that we come to work to do two jobs, the job we're employed to do and the job of managing other people's impressions of us.
Yes. So interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
And in that statement, implicit in it is relations of power. But yeah, you can lose those if you just focus on the neat quote sort of thing, you know.
Yeah.
All the impression management is about how is what am I going to say, or how is my appearance going to be judged, and you know, by those who can make a difference. And it can be just your peers. You know, there's nothing. The power of peer group is so powerful in all of this.
It absolutely is. It absolutely is. And Jeff, you had an example of, and this is, you know, we're going to share different examples today, but this is unfortunately a dysfunctional one, which is a pretty extreme example where power came into play in the case of Dominic Raab. I wonder if you could tell us a bit more about that.
I can tell you, yes. And I mean, we are looking at the negative side in this example, and that's often the side that gets emphasised. So we, you know, you've already noted that there's the positive side too. But I guess it's important to notice because of the impact on people. And it is so common. As I tell this this account, really, many people listening will be able to map onto their own version of it, you know, probably in organisations or other places like schools and that. But so Dominic Raab was a minister in the UK government, and he resigned this year because of an official report into his style of leadership. And I'll quote from the report, say, in his management choice, Mr. Raab acted in ways that was intimidating in the sense of unreasonable, persistent, aggressive conduct. His conduct involved an abuse or misuse of power in a way that undermines or humiliates. Behaviour described as bullying, persistently aggressive, controlling, intimidating, and insulting. And the bit that kind of raised a kind of a smile, though it's not really not funny, was that he was nicknamed the incinerator because of how quickly he burns through employees. And of course, he had his defence here. He said he insists on high standards and acted professionally at all times. And just to make the point that he was the deputy prime minister when our favourite person, Boris Johnson, was in hospital with COVID. So he was actually running the country at that point, and he was involved in minister around Brexit and health. So he was having a big, powerful effect on the way the whole country was run. And, you know, what are the effects on the people? Well, again, from the report, it said staff suffered significant negative impacts on their psychological well-being after coming into contact with him. They suffered stress, anxiety, and felt forced to take special unpaid leave. There were reports of staff in tears or vomiting before meetings, creating an atmosphere of fear and anxiety. And you know, I'm guessing lots of people listening might have some experiences of maybe not so strong as this, but I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, I don't know if you've had any met people or any examples.
Yeah, I mean, that all sounds quite extreme, Jeff, but yet there are bits of that happening every day of the week to different people in the workplace. And I remember in my 20s, working on a particular project, and I joined at the same day as somebody else, and we were in the lift going up to the project, where the project was situated, and one of the managers turned to us and said, "You've got to pretend you know what you're talking about." And in that moment, that created something or a sense of unease, and my colleague was physically ill every day for 3 weeks before going to work. So we didn't have somebody shouting at us. We didn't have that, but there was this sense of unease or being concerned about being found out. Again, it comes back to this managing people's impressions of us. But what I find really curious, Jeff, is I kind of wonder then, what happens to the decision-making and the creativity in an environment like that?
Yeah, well, I mean, guess you just said some of it, like you have to pretend you know what you're talking about. And I'm guessing with Dominic Raab, he wasn't keen to get dissent or uncertainty. And what then happens to the decision, say, an organisation makes on the basis of that kind of communication and information?
Jeff, I think in the last podcast, we might have mentioned the piece of research that was done around organisational silence, and that something like 85% of people had experiences of not speaking up on something that they thought was important. Mm. And so how does that then play into decisions and all that? And so it's not just about the individuals, I guess, and the impact on them, but it's the impact on the bottom line.
Yep. And
there was a great example used by Professor Amy Edmondson in one of her books around Dieselgate, which was when Volkswagen were effectively found out by the Environmental Protection Agency in the US, because there was a piece of software put into the car, which meant that the emissions were dialed down basically when emissions were being tested. So when the testing kicked in, this piece of software code, kicked into action and understated the emissions. But the EPA in the US discovered this, and it led to massive reputational damage and financial loss for Volkswagen. And there was investigation done into what went on. And ultimately, they put it down to a cultural issue within the organization. When the issue came to light initially, the CEO just kind of pointed the finger and said it was a small bunch of people who were behind it. But ultimately, what's kind of generally understood now is that it was a culture of fear in the organization, a fear and ambition, I guess I would say, in that. And then there's nothing wrong with ambition, but they were coupled together where the board and the CEO were really, really driven to achieve results, all of which is good stuff, but they couldn't take no for an answer. And as that rippled down through the organization, it meant that people ended up doing things that they shouldn't have done to achieve the results because they felt that they couldn't say no. And approximately 40 people, they reckon, actually knew about this software code. But that information did not ripple up, which is really interesting.
When I said earlier about people learn to navigate the lines of power, if you like, and both in terms of fear and in terms of ambition. If I'm ambitious, I know what, probably know, you know, the way to behave, what to say, that's going to go down well and so forth. So we've been concentrating just here on the negative sides, and it's so important to catch hold of the effects on people and the effects on decision making and that. But I guess we also want to pay attention to the positive side when power is used in an affirmative way building good relationships. And I think back to what I said in the first podcast there about that coaching culture where the CEO's beginning used to issue these, I think, JFDIs, just F and do it, and shifted the culture so that people ended up saying they just couldn't believe the trust that was in the organisation. And I wonder if you know, you've got some thoughts on this.
Yeah, and you know, when you talk about kind of using power for the good end of things, I think about shaping culture, shaping a culture that's constructive and, you know, I don't want to get to the end point too quickly, but kind of leveling the power a little bit so people can actually be their best selves. But a couple of weeks ago, I was watching a Netflix series with one of my daughters, and it was called The Playbook, A Coach's Rules for Life. And I came across this guy who's really interesting called Doc Rivers. And he's an NBA head coach, or at least he was, initially of the LA Clippers and then the Boston Celtics. And when he took over coaching the Boston Celtics, he was really aware that he had three stars, absolutely individual stars on the team. But he knew he needed to get them to work together as a team, because otherwise these guys would be in competition with each other and it wasn't going to result in the outcomes that they needed. So he was talking to, you know, different people about it and trying to figure out what to do. And somebody, this lady, said to him, "Doc, you need to look up the word Ubuntu." So that's U-B-U-N-T-U. He said, "You need to look up the word Ubuntu. It's a word, but it's not just a word. It's a way of life." So he went home and he looked up the word Ubuntu. And as the story goes, at 6 a.m. the following morning, he was still going. He had his notebook and pen and was still looking it up and investigating it. And I won't claim to fully get it, Jeff, but the term, it means humanity, apparently. And it refers to the fact that kind of we as individuals are part of a larger whole. There's a description given, "I am because we are." You can have an authentic individual human being as part of a larger, more significant relational communal world. So essentially what he was trying to do was create a sense of community in the team, where instead of people competing against each other, they were actually playing for the community, which in this case is the team. There's a great phrase that was used, which is, "I can't be threatened because you are good, because the better you are, the better I can be." So he put this to the rookies on the team as a proposal that, can we build this culture on the team? The rookies bought it. They pitched it to the more senior members of the team. And without much debate or conversation, they all went into a huddle and called out the word Ubuntu. And from there, that became the kind of team motto, which lived on. And even at a later stage, he thought about shifting it to something else. And the team went, "No, it's Ubuntu. That's what we do." So something really powerful about that, Jeff, that story, which really resonated with me. I wonder what strikes you about it.
You spoke to me about it once and you said that the team called him on it.
Yeah. So he got onto a bus one time with a hamburger and one of the guys said to him, "You're not doing Ubuntu, man." Because you need to put the team first. So the idea is that you look out for others on the team. It's not just about serving your own needs. And the way he went about it, I thought was really interesting. There were three things, specific things that he did in his term as head coach there. And by the way, they won the NBA World Championship that year. So this is not just all nice and fluffy stuff. They actually succeeded and they won the championship that year. But the first thing he does at the start of every season is he says, "I'm Doc Rivers, I'm human, and I'm going to make mistakes." So in that statement, he expresses his vulnerability and creates a sense of safety that we're all human. I mean, that's not what's said, but that's the implication. We're all human and we're going to make mistakes. And that's the first thing. That's how he starts every season. And then the second thing was obviously this creation of this, or the establishment of this philosophy Ubuntu, which, you know, in its own way created a set of ground rules around culture in terms of what was acceptable and what wasn't acceptable, with selfish acts not being allowed. He, at one stage, he said, "You know, the decisions I make will be good for the team. They may not be good for you or for me, but they will be good for the team." So it's very clear it was going to be team first. And the third thing he did, and this was a fabulous thing as well, Jeff, that really struck me, was his focus on purpose, relentless focus on purpose. They had won different competitions, but it was the championship they were after. And they had these, you know, flags or whatever up, which illustrated the times they'd won the championship before. But he found a blank spot on a wall and he put up a spotlight, which just focused on this blank spot. And when they went in the next day, he asked the guys, did they notice it? And one of them did. And they said, "So what's that?" And he said, "That is where the flag will go when we win the championship this year." So every day they turned up to training, they saw the spotlight on this blank piece of the wall.
Yeah.
And so they knew what their purpose was.
Yeah. That's such a kind of a good story. And I just want to underline the fact that it was his use of good authority there, his use of power for positives. He said, I will be making the decisions, which may not you may not like, and so forth. And so he was owning the power he had, and he was using it to create the culture. And I guess both power and psychological well-being, as we've said, it's worth underlining, is situational. And it is the culture, say a culture of an organisation, that is the fundamental reference point for all of this.
Yeah, and I think that's really interesting what you said, is that he didn't shy away from the power, but and by sharing his vulnerability, he didn't lessen his power.
Yeah.
He was just saying, I'm human, we all make mistakes, but yet he still owned the power and that he was the ultimate decision maker.
Yeah. So just, you know, being able to unpack some of that about to acknowledge, to own your power, your legitimate power is vital, because some people tend to, you know, shy away from it, you know, because they feel like power is bad. You know, they might want to deny what they have, but it's the purpose, as you say, to which it's put, and the way that you engage with the community you're part of as to whether they feel safe to speak. And so forth.
Jeff, there was another one which I know we haven't spoken of, which is in the previous team he was in with the LA Clippers, there was a really difficult period of time that he had where, so he's a Black American, much of his team are Black Americans, and the owner of the LA Clippers was an older white gentleman who ended up having a recording taken of him speaking in racist terms to his wife. And that came out into the media. And then he had to face the backlash of his team. And he went in and he got abused from them. He had a decision to make about whether to wear his LA Clippers top or not. And he took the decision, I'm the coach of the team, I'm going to wear it. But when he went in, none of his team were wearing them. And he sat down and he was on the receiving end of some, you know, a torrent of not abuse, but like, you know, the emotion from the team about how they felt about all this. And then he had to stop and kind of go. He then told them about his background. He said, I am a Black American. So first and foremost, that's who I am. So he took off the power in some ways and actually became one of them. And then he wanted them to deal with it as a team, but internally as a team, so the spotlight could stay on the owner of the LA Clippers and the inappropriate behaviour that he had actually exhibited. So I know that's slightly off topic, but it's just his, I guess when you say it's situational, he chose the moments when to use it, when not to use it, when to be one of them, when he needed to be an authority. And I thought that was interesting.
Another example comes to my mind when we talk about shirts and things and authority. It's Nelson Mandela. When he chose to wear the Springbok vest, if you like, and support as a way, and went out to shake the hand of the, in this instance, you know, the white captain of the Springbok rugby team. And so many of his people were really angry with him and said, you should not do this. But his sense was, we need to reach across the divide. So he used his good authority, his power, to make the gesture. And so it's really interesting just to you know, good authority can be making decisions that in the moment others just don't agree with. But
do you know, Jeff, that's so interesting you mention him, because he was mentioned in the same context as Ubuntu, that he also used the phrase Ubuntu. Nelson Mandela did.
Okay. So I wonder if we can draw out some of the, you know, what are the practices, if you like, that those listening to these grand tales,
yeah,
more everyday practices that contribute to this sense of good authority and enabling a sense of well-being and psychological safety.
So I guess if I take the kind of the key things from Doc Rivers, first of all, maybe, I think those three things that he did, one was, you know, expressing vulnerability and creating a sense of safety at the outset. The second thing was creating or shaping a culture. You don't create a culture, I guess you shape it, and everybody inputs to the culture, but shaping a culture which, you know, where there are things which are acceptable and not acceptable in terms of behaviours, and there's accountability to that. And the thirdly, the relentless focus on purpose. But I'm reminded of Timothy Clark is a guy who wrote a book on psychological safety. And in that book, he says the paradox of being a CEO is that your job is to encourage useful ideas, and yet your very presence can work against that objective. And so for me, it's how do you dial down the power? And if we take it into an organizational setting, how do we dial down that power so we can get the best out of people? And he wrote an HBR article called How a CEO Can Create Psychological Safety in the Room. And you can simply Google that and find out what there's some, you know, very simple things that he suggests that we can do, that anybody can do to kind of level that that power so people can be at their best. And will I share a few of those, Jeff, maybe? So his first one is that, you know, not to sit at the head of the table. Because if we're at the head of the table, we're obviously exhibiting that power in a very physical way. And he said that we should model acts of vulnerability, which is, of course, exactly what Doc Rivers did. He said that we should inquire before we advocate. So we should practice asking questions. And a phrase that I love to use, Jeff, which is borrowed from Jennifer Garvey Berger, is to listen to learn then. So we're actually not just asking a question and ignoring what's being said. We're actually listening to learn rather than listening to win or to fix. We're actually listening to learn. He says that we should buffer strong personalities. So if there are some of those voices that are heard a lot more than others, that we need to manage that so it creates space for everybody to take part. And he talks about creating warmth and informality. And of course, it's, you know, we all know that it's those conversations at the water cooler that that often we learn the most. So if we can create a sense of warmth and informality, we're likely to create that sense of safety to a greater extent that people will feel comfortable to contribute.
They're all really important. I guess my thoughts have just emerged out of this conversation is, and it's really important for each of us to realize that, if you like, the lines of power that are in place here, and both the formal lines but also the informal lines, and also to recognize, to own our own power, if you like, and to be mindful of how we use that, and not sort of reject the notion we have it, just inquire. And I just think that extra awareness can help us realize, you know, we're part of a community, a group, and what's my impact here? And you know, more so as we go up the, you know, the lines of power, if you like, in an organization, where the impact of what we do will be greater and greater. So it's not to disown power, but it's to really recognize its impact.
I think that's a really important thing that you said about owning our own power and stepping into it.
Yeah, I get that.
So Jeff, we were to wrap this up. What I'm hearing is that, you know, we need to be aware of the power lines. There's ways that we can actually level the power. If we're the person who's the ultimate authority in a room, whether that's CEO, chair, or, you know, team leader, there's ways that we can actually level the power so that other people can feel more comfortable. But then for us as individuals, when we show up, we need to be aware of us actually stepping into our own power so that we can actually contribute what we need to contribute for the benefit of not just ourselves, but for the team as well.
And all those, what you've just been saying, contribute to that notion of psychological safety or lack of it. So the more somebody feels like they've got a place here, they're accepted, they're listened to, they might not like what's going to be happening, but they've had their say. All these sorts of things. That's the back and forth between power and psychological safety.
And then the next day, Jeff, in terms of conversation, we're going to be inviting Noel Gavin to join us. And he's a senior vice president in Northern Trust. We're going to be talking about diversity and inclusion, which, as you said at the very outset, is kind of the flip side of this. This is where people maybe don't feel that power. And we're going to explore how that plays into to this conversation.
That's good. That's good. It's interesting how all the different subjects, they play off each other. You know,
yeah,
we'll probably counter similar themes and ways of, you know, to deal with stuff. But the many facets of this.
Exactly, exactly. Well, thank you so much for the conversation today, Jeff. And looking forward to the next conversation with Noel very soon.
Yeah, I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you.